Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from Space Beans Coffee, committed to fueling the daily journey from morning grogginess to the peak of productivity, offering a variety of brews, including Go for Launch, Dark Side of the Moon, Rocket to Mars, and more. Available at their Melbourne cafe or online at spacebeans.com.
Impending doom from asteroids and backing up data on the moon. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. About the size of a football field and nearing Earth's orbit, one asteroid has less than 1% chance of hitting us. It could, but it's almost impossible. But what if an asteroid did hit Earth? And how are we keeping track of these dangerous objects? We'll speak with University of Central Florida's Audrey Martin, Addie Dove, and Josh Caldwell about those questions and about what would happen if an asteroid did indeed hit our planet. Then, could the moon be a giant backup device? Lone Star Data Holdings Incorporated is using the moon as a destination for a data hub to promote the lunar economy and to protect data from earthly threats. We'll speak with Lone Star's Christopher Stott about how the company is looking at the future of data storage from the lunar surface. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Are we going to get hit by a giant asteroid in 2032? Astronomers are tracking the asteroid 2024 YR4 as it approaches near Earth's orbit. While it's about the size of a football field and would be deadly if it hit our planet, the chances of it colliding into Earth have decreased to near zero. While asteroids can be large like this one, they can be very difficult for astronomers to track. But with strategies like planetary defense and the help of high-tech telescopes, NASA and partners can identify and try to prevent an asteroid from clobbering our planet. Here to talk about this asteroid and why it originally had a high chance of hitting Earth are the hosts of the Walk About the Galaxy podcast. They're also planetary scientists at the University of Central Florida. Josh, Audrey, Eddie, welcome back.
Yay.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, so some good news. The asteroid isn't going to hit us.
Boo.
Nope. Depends on your perspective.
Yeah. But this is still a really good opportunity to talk about how we track this stuff in the first place. So yes. For a brief time, there was a very small percentage that this thing could possibly hit us. Josh, let's start with you. How do you even track this? This seemed to come out of nowhere.
Well, near-Earth asteroids are hard to see because their orbits are very similar to ours. Frequently, they're in a sort of bad orientation relative to the sun. And we're talking about small objects here, too, mm-hmm. So they're not very bright in the sky. And there are lots of surveys out there. There are space-based telescopes, ground-based observatories that are automated out there doing full sky scans all the time and identifying populations of these objects. Then it's like you got to observe them for a while to figure out what the orbital path is like. Mm-hmm. You see a thing moving with over a very short arc, it's hard to know exactly where it's going.
Audrey, is this an intentional survey of the sky, or do these things just kind of pop out and then you're like, oh, crap?
These are very intentional surveys of the sky. This one was discovered by ATLAS from a telescope in Chile, and there's a couple of different telescopes around the world that take full sky images every single night, weather permitting.
That's good to know that there are these things out there looking for this.
Yeah, this is part of a sort of a coordinated planetary defense strategy that NASA and other nations have of like doing these things where we survey the sky and look for all of these objects. And we had a goal, I forget what the goal was. It was to detect all asteroids over a size of like 100 meters, I'm going to say. That's probably wrong. Mm-hmm. And we did that. And so now we're looking for even smaller objects. Mm-hmm. And this just helps with this sort of long-term understanding if there are things out there that are maybe going to hit us. Mm-hmm.
I know we heard about these percentages of impact. Now we're down to zero.
What I saw this morning was 0.001%.
Oh, so you're saying there's a chance.
There's always a chance.
Sure.
How do you even get to that, Addie? Does this change over time because the course of this asteroid changes, or just the data that we're getting is getting better and better?
The 0.001% chance is actually a very small percent mm-hmm. chance. So it's statistically, it's not going to hit us. The sort of peak was somewhere around 3% chance. It was like 2 mm-hmm. point something, which is actually a huge chance for like these objects. Like mm-hmm. statistically, all of the things in the sky, very, very low. It's like usually 0.000 something, right, percent mm-hmm. chance. So 2% chance, 3% chance was actually really huge. That percentage changes because we get more data. Mm-hmm. So when it was first detected with ATLAS, we said, okay, it's probably on this orbit. But that was its first detection. So we only had a tiny bit of data of what its orbit actually looked like. So then people have been scrambling to do follow-up observations with lots of different satellites and really get better details of what its orbit is, and you get that by seeing where it is over the course of several months. And that helps you refine its orbit, and then we can say, no, this will not cross the Earth and hit us.
Mm-hmm.
It will cross our orbit, but it won't hit us.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be no surprises, right? Because the rules of physics are unchanging and math is certain.
Correct.
Right?
Mostly.
Mm-hmm. Mostly.
Yeah. There are things called like perturbations and things like this asteroid is goes out through the main asteroid belt and sort of kind of near Jupiter. Those things can have perturbations. If it gets too close to Jupiter, it can change its orbit, things like that. But those are things we can predict.
If it were to hit Earth, what would that look like?
This is a sort of Tunguska scale impact. We don't know exactly how big it is because we don't know how reflective it is. So we see a bright dot, dim dot. The size depends on how reflective it is. We'll get more data on that looking at other wavelengths and narrow that down. But it's sort of football field size, maybe 50 meters across up to maybe 100 meters across. Yeah. So that's sort of
that's quite large.
The size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's larger than a lot of the things that we've talked about recently. We see car-sized or truck-sized things coming in, and those typically don't have any impact on the Earth at all. There's nothing you need to worry about. Something this size, that's about the size of the thing that created the Barringer crater in Arizona.
Northern Arizona.
Okay.
Which is a pretty good-sized crater.
Mm-hmm.
It'll create localized damage if it hits a place that other than the ocean, right? Where is it most likely to hit?
The ocean.
The Tunguska impact was a little bit smaller than this, and it exploded in the atmosphere. So it deposited all of its energy in the atmosphere. It was close enough to the ground that it flattened a forest.
Okay. So, pressure wave that flattened a forest. Yeah.
What was that word you said?
Tunguska is the location in Siberia of an impactor in 1908, which is, I think, the most recent impactor of that scale that we know of.
Could there be long-term effects of these asteroid strikes, or if it smashes somewhere, it just does its local damage and then that's it?
This particular impactor doesn't have the potential to do like climate change or that kind of thing, like, you know, dinosaur ending event or something like that. It's a localized destruction.
It would
devastating locally.
Yes, it would be devastating locally. There would be days, weeks, maybe months of like fallout and atmospheric changes and stuff like that. It's sort of more comparable to things like some of like the Tonga, the big eruption.
Like a volcano.
Like a big volcanic eruption
okay.
in terms of perturbations. And that can cause things like tsunamis and things like that too. So if it hits in the ocean, it won't hit a city, but it could cause tsunamis or something like that that could affect coastal areas.
Mm-hmm.
And potentially, I mean, if it were to hit land, we would know ahead of time and we would be able to like do evacuations and things like that, right? So.
And that is because we have things like planetary defenses that are looking for these things.
Yes. Okay.
You talk about planetary defense.
Yeah.
We can spot these things. Do we have an opportunity to deflect these things?
Well, we tried that with DART, and we were pretty successful with changing the orbit of a very small satellite around another asteroid. There is going to be a follow-up mission to look at the aftermath of the DART impact, but we have some things in place, and we're trying to study better ways to deflect asteroids.
Yeah, I mean, there are ideas for missions that could sort of be in place and be ready to launch, and you just have to, if you hit it far enough away, you just have to bump it a little bit to send it on a slightly different course, and then it won't hit Earth.
But let's talk about some of the perks of this. Audrey, I know you study asteroids, right?
Yeah, I do.
You've got a near-Earth asteroid coming relatively close to our planet. Is that like a planetary scientist like yourself's dream to get it so close?
Absolutely. It's really, really cool. Right now, we are kind of ending the time period where we can collect spectra and determine what the composition of this object is. But because it's going to come so close, we can get really good compositional data. We can get really good radar data. So knowing kind of the shape of it, knowing its spin orientation and all of that, because it is coming in so close. So it's very, very exciting.
And part of that with a spectra is it needs to be close in, so it's getting enough sunlight to be able to actually make those observations. And so it'll be close again in about 4 years, so in 2028. And then in 2032 is when it's close, the really close encounter, where we'll get lots of additional data.
Yeah. And what could this tell us? Like where is this asteroid coming from, and what will its composition tell you about our solar system?
Oh, yeah. So right now, the compositional information, like I said, isn't very high. It's either an S-type, which means stony, made of rock, so there were potentially igneous things going on this object, or K-type, which is very primitive, made of minerals that condensed out of the solar nebula first. So if it's a K-type, then we can learn about the very first things that formed in our solar system. If it's an S-type, then we can learn about the types of metamorphism and other types of alteration that go on these really small objects.
And is there a possibility that post-2032, this thing could get closer to us?
I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen the dynamic
projections afterwards.
After 2032, I think we have more data now, so they mm-hmm. probably have better estimates of that.
Mm-hmm. It gets fuzzier and fuzzier and fuzzier the farther you go in the future.
But as you mentioned at the beginning, Brendan, that this thing sort of came out of nowhere. It's like we hadn't heard about it before it was discovered very recently. And with all these observational campaigns, we're discovering these objects. We want to discover the vast majority of them greater than a certain size that are potentially threatening. But there was always a new supply of potentially hazardous asteroids because the orbits of asteroids do evolve over time. Mm-hmm. So the population of near-Earth objects, potentially hazardous asteroids, is not a fixed unchanging population. Like once you see it, you're done. It's always evolving because new asteroids are coming in from the asteroid belt and other locations, and they're getting perturbations that we haven't predicted fully.
Yeah, this one's part of a family of asteroids that sort of come from out in the asteroid belt and go almost out all the way to Jupiter and then comes into the Earth orbit. It's not a very circular orbit. It's a more elliptical orbit, so it can come in close to the Earth and be a near-Earth asteroid. But it spends a lot more of its time sort of out, a little bit further out, but closer to Jupiter and the rest of the asteroid belt. Can have friends out there, too.
I know a lot of the resources that go into tracking these things come from public dollars. Mm-hmm. Public dollars are controlled by public opinion. This asteroid, you know, was making headlines when it was potentially a threat. It's gotten people to really think and talk about these potential threats from these near-Earth asteroids. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is going to give a push to create some greater funding to get other observatories in space like NEOWISE and things like that?
I hope so. Yeah, absolutely. It was discovered by a NASA-funded facility, and the people that were working at the facility and doing the detections get their funding from NASA as well. And it's useful. It's really useful, and we need it, and we need more of them.
There was a sort of surprising public survey in the U.S. like 2 years ago, maybe. It was prior to the election. And it was about like what folks think of as priorities for space and for space funding. It actually came out that planetary defense and like asteroid detection was fairly high on the list for public opinion. And that is because like it's a sort of a known thing that like, hey, this is something that could physically affect us here on Earth a lot more than sort of like grand ideas of exploration can. Right. So there was actually a push from that to do more funding for planetary defense.
It really brings it into the public consciousness when you have movies
like Deep Impact and such, right? Yes. I mean, finally, I guess we'll end this because, you know, usually I have you on here when there's something scary happening. This is not scary anymore. Now it's a very, very small percentage. What
Sorry
else? Yeah. What should I be worried about before 2032? Oh.
You should be worried about the one that's going to hit that we haven't seen yet.
Okay.
We're entering a phase, we're sort of in the time right now of solar maximum. So the sun has various cycles where it's sort of more active and less active, and we're sort of in a more active period right now, which means it can send off big things called coronal mass ejections, CMEs, that are sort of big bursts of energy that have electrical particles and things like that, can disrupt satellites, can mess up our atmosphere, and it can actually disrupt electronics here on Earth.
It won't change the orbit of an asteroid, though?
A really tiny asteroid,
yeah,
might.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll change the orbit of satellites,
Earth orbiting
satellites,
which terrifying.
Can then end up coming in and putting on a light show, at least, as they burn up in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Josh, Addy, and Audrey, thank you three for both being here, and definitely tune in.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. That was UCF's Addy Dove, Josh Caldwell, and Audrey Martin. They host the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. Get it wherever you get this podcast. Still to come, a hard drive on the moon.
We're able to communicate all the time. Think of it as a living, breathing hard drive for the planet.
Using Earth's closest neighbor to hold our data. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, presenting Parkinson's IQ Plus U, Saturday, March 15th, and open to the public. This event offers those living with Parkinson's and their loved ones a day of educational programming and connection with local community. Registration and more at michaeljfox.org/PDIQ Orlando.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. A new satellite aims to study and map the moon's water. The Trailblazer spacecraft will provide detailed maps of the moon, and with these maps, Trailblazer could help the crew of the Artemis missions bring lunar ice samples back to Earth. But it was a long road to launch. We'll get a behind-the-scenes look of this story with Joe Palca, a science journalist and former NPR science correspondent. He joins the program later this month on Are We There Yet? But for now, our focus on the moon turns from drips and drops of water to bits and bytes of data. What if one day all the data we have suddenly vanishes? Lone Star Data Holdings Incorporated is creating a hard drive for the planet, and while the company is on Earth, they are expanding their data center to Earth's closest neighbor, the moon. Just last month, Lone Star launched its payload, the world's first data center to the moon. It's named the Freedom Payload. Here to talk more about Lone Star's Freedom Data Center and why the moon was chosen to host it is Christopher Stott, the founder, chair, and CEO of Lone Star Data Holdings Incorporated. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Chris, you've got a mission heading to the moon, right? Tell us a bit about what you sent to the moon.
This is a Freedom Payload. This is the world's first data center headed to the moon. SAS recovery, resiliency as a service. And as we speak this morning, it was just made public. We entered lunar orbit. So you have Firefly, amazing partners and great people who landed yesterday on the moon, an American company, for the second commercial landing on the moon. And here we go, hopefully this week, with Intuitive Machines' second landing themselves coming up this Thursday.
Chris, before we get too far into what you're actually attempting to do, I want to just repeat something that you just said. You've got confirmation that the payload has reached lunar orbit. What does that feel like for someone like you who has been working on this for years?
We love it. We have an incredible team here at Lone Star, and we've got people who worked on space missions all their lives, and we all sit here on console, they're doing it right now, and we all just kind of go, oh my gosh, we have a moment where we all kind of grin like schoolchildren because we love it so much. And then we go back to being absolutely professional. We're on loop, we're doing our work. But it's just the most amazing feeling that we can look up in the moon, look up tonight, any night, and know that American entrepreneurs have gone back to the moon. 50 years, more than 50 years actually, since we last went back with Apollo 17. And us using space as a data center company for resilient backup. As Billy Bob Thornton said, his character said in Armageddon, this is why we have a space program.
Chris, you mentioned resilient backup. Can you talk a bit about what your company Lone Star is hoping to do with this mission and missions that will come after it?
Our whole goal, I mean, our company motto was saving Earth's data one byte at a time. There's this idea that data is one of the most important things in our society today. Outside of us as humans and people, I'd say it is the most important. It gives us our technological civilization. It allows us to do everything that we do. And our societies are changing so fast with exponential technology. We're just creating more and more data. We need to keep a copy of it. We have one really big example from human history when we didn't, and it still haunts us 2,000 years later. That was the burning of the Library of Alexandria by Julius Caesar's troops in the Roman Civil War. Imagine if that happened today. And we work with governments. We work with our state government here in Florida, who are incredible to work with. Very avant-garde, very forward-thinking, leveraging 60 years of sunk investment in the space program to protect our citizens' data. And we're doing this with Enterprise and others around the world to actually just turn the moon into a giant backup device. Especially as the world gets a little bit more uncertain and unstable, the idea that we're protecting our data by keeping it somewhere away from all of the storms and wars and everything else, and leveraging our space technology to do so.
It's interesting to think about it this way, because I can attest to this. I just assume data is in the cloud everywhere, right? But it physically has to be stored somewhere, whether it's here on Earth, which it has been for the past centuries, but now it will be stored on the moon. Tell me a bit about the hardware that's actually storing this data.
Yeah, we're working with and utilizing solid state devices, SSDs. The easiest way to think about this is the thumb drive that you use to get your photos and data and music off your computer. Our thumb drives are just a little bit bigger and a little bit more powerful. We work with Phison, who's the world's number one provider of thumb drives, solid state devices with the Pascari brand. And this mission, we're taking 8 terabytes up and testing that. Uniquely commercial drives. Up in the radiation and cold and vacuum of space. These are the same drives that are active on Mars, in the Mars rovers and helicopters. They're active on space station, but it's not your average thumb drive. You know, this is something that has 8 terabytes on one drive. It's 8,000 gigabytes on one drive, which is absolutely amazing. And as we go forward, we are putting up petabyte level machines and within 2 years to go orbit around the moon and provide backup for the planet.
Chris, are you able to communicate with these devices and upload and download data from the lunar surface?
We're able to communicate all the time. Think of it as a living, breathing hard drive for the planet.
That is wild to think about. What are your upload and download speeds?
Oh, at the moment, we're working with Intuitive Machines, our incredible providers. So this is our what we call our Kitty Hawk moment. If you compare a 787 to what the Wright brothers first flew in Kitty Hawk, right? So we're really testing things out. We're pushing the envelope on this mission. As we go forward, though, we are going straight to that 787 size. We'll be up in the gigabytes per second each way. And as we move forward, we'll be in the hundreds of gigabytes per second each way for our transmissions to and from the moon.
That is fascinating. And how does that transmission happen?
Early stage, radio frequencies. We have our spectrum filings at the ITU. And you know, one does not simply go to space. Space is the most regulated of all human activity. And for us and our work, the first thing you do in a spaceflight company is you get the permission to talk to your spacecraft without causing interference to anyone else. And that's called a spectrum filing at the International Telecommunications Union in Geneva. We've secured our filings. They're called IOMs at HAL. HAL named after Sir Arthur Clarke, which coincidentally, and I love the fact that we're talking today, because today, 30 years ago, this very day, I was sitting as a young man in Colombo in Sri Lanka doing some work over there. And I had the privilege to go spend a day with Sir Arthur Clarke, who then very kindly became a mentor and introduced me to my grad school at the International Space University, got me in. And here we are 30 years later. Putting computers on the moon.
He would certainly be proud of that moment. You briefly mentioned this in an earlier response, Chris, but you know, the moon is a pretty harsh environment. How do you prepare this hardware to live on the lunar surface and still be functional so that you're able to access this data for many, many years?
We have sunk knowledge. We understand the radiation environment. Well, we're testing radiation. We understand the radiation environment, but our contractor Space Built is flying an RMAS radiation center for space works alongside us. We have fault detection software from the Exploration Institute. We're using a delay tolerant network from Vince Cerf and his solar system internet team. We're running LLMs and knowledge graphs from Valkyrie Intelligence to test out edge processing with data from Harvard. And we have data stored on board. And we test all of this before we go, because once it's gone, it's gone. As an industry, we routinely build spacecraft satellites that provide your television and internet and everything else. And they're about the size of a small house and they last 20 years up in incredible radiation environments. But we test them before we fly. So for this, we had to meet the requirements for SpaceX to launch, the requirements for Intuitive Machines provider to take us. Vibration testing, thermal vacuum testing, shake and bake, we call it. We had to do electromagnetic interference, EMI testing in anaerobic chambers. Test again, and you must pass these tests. Otherwise, you don't get a license and you can't fly.
Shake and bake. I love that term. Little Ricky Bobby moment there. What about power? How are you tapping into power? Does it take a lot of power to run these quote-unquote data centers on the moon?
We're lucky because we're using solar power and we're naturally cooled. But you're right. The cloud itself isn't a cloud. It's these massive facilities we have here on Earth, our terrestrial partners and data centers, and they consume a fair amount of power because they're doing amazing things for us, give off a fair amount of heat. And one of the largest costs is cooling these data centers. In space, we get natural cooling, and we get literal power from that great big ball of fusion in the sky and the sun. But also, we're using space-qualified equipment. So when you're flying a helicopter on Mars, you've got a space station up there, whatever you're doing, we, for the last 60 years, have actually been using very lightweight, low mass, but high capability equipment that uses very little power. For example, this next set of missions, we're looking at a multi-petabyte level satellite. When we're looking, say, at 15 petabytes, we do that with the equivalent of about 800 watts. Whereas on the ground, that would be close to 180 kilowatts. So we're 300 times less power use. And yet we are just as capable.
This may be a silly question, but why specifically the moon? Could something like this exist in low Earth orbit, which, you know, there seem to be far more rides going there than to the moon? Why specifically lunar surface?
Now, we looked at this. We looked at underwater data centers. We looked at data centers in jungles and deserts, underneath mountains, on tops of mountains. And we looked at low Earth orbit and geo. The realization we came to was of manyfold. Number one, it was safer to do it from cislunar space and the moon, Earth's largest satellite. It was more cost effective. It was more elegant in terms of orbital dynamics. But also, a lot of us have worked on programs over the last 30 years of our careers and longer, where if you want to keep something safe, you don't really put it in low Earth orbit. During the first Cold War, you'd never put anything in LEO that you wanted to keep safe, because it was coming back one way or the other. And also, when you look at the cost of coverage, time, spectrum issues, jamming debris, Russian anti-satellite weapons testing, even up at GEO, you've got a fair amount of issues, and you need 3 satellites to cover the world. Ironically, our CFO is amazing, former head of satellite financing in Morgan Stanley. And even Carol's mind was blown by this when we looked at this, and we said, oh my gosh, it's more cost effective to do this from the moon. We see the entire world once every 24 hours, and we're far enough away to leverage latency to make ourselves more secure.
Finally, Chris, the pitch that was given to me is that this is going to be, it's going to save all of humanity's history, so we don't have a Library of Alexandria problem like we did some 2,000 years ago. But I've got to imagine there's a commercial business case for this as well, right? I mean, do commercial companies want to store their data on the moon? And is that where this company is heading?
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, Dr. Peter Diamandis, founder of the XPRIZE and Singularity University, International Space University, and all these others, he has a great saying. He says, every major problem facing the human race is also an opportunity. So what we're trying to do here is, you know, we're venture capital funded. This is entrepreneurial. We're making a service, and we're already in revenue. We're making a service whereby we're backing up premium data, mission critical data for our governments, for our corporations, for our citizens, and even our NGOs. Just yesterday, we were greatly honored to be able to send a complete set of names for the Medal of Honor Foundation to the lunar surface for safekeeping. And we do that for others. Platymillion Corals, our carbon sequestration partner, where we go off and help rebuild coral reefs and actually sequester carbon, which helps us get to net zero and all sorts of other wonderful things. It's a big deal. And here's the other thing too. If we weren't doing this, who else is? And we're very fortunate to have the VC funders come to us and say, we see an opportunity here. Let's do good by doing good.
This is your Kitty Hawk moment, as you've described it. How soon do you get to that jumbo jet?
18 months. That's how fast exponential tech is pushing us.
Wow.
And it's a way of testing everything we need to do on this. And then once that test is complete, and knock on wood so far, we actually hit all of our commercial milestones en route to the moon. And we have done all of our edge processing, all of our disaster recovery for every single customer multiple times. We even added extra tasks, extra data that was unexpected, retrieved data, sent data, processed data that no one had even anticipated on this mission, and all done successfully thanks to our team, thanks to Intuitive Machines and a great partnership. We hope many years from now, people will just look at the moon and go, well, of course I keep my data there. Why? Where did you keep yours? Nicole Stott, astronaut, might notice a similar last name. Very lucky to have married my best friend. Nikki spent 104 days up on space station, and she's been fantastic at working with us on this. She looks at the moon, and her quote was that the moon is so good for data storage, if it wasn't there, we'd have to build it.
We've been speaking with Christopher Stott. He is the founder, chair, and CEO of Lone Star Data Holdings Incorporated, with a successful payload on the moon. Christopher, congratulations, and thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me today.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe to it on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, a question you want us to answer, or you think you might be a good guest, shoot us an email. Are we there yet? @cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? This is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Allison Castillo. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.